Reminds me of I've met a few people who used to work for, well, I probably shouldn't say their name, but one of the world leading HSM companies, hardware secure modules. They make private key storage for big banks and so on and so on. Yeah, their opinion was the hardware wallets in the Bitcoin space were quite superior
No
to what
kidding.
yeah.
This is a chat with Douglas Backham, the CEO of Shift Crypto. We talk about Bitcoin, hardware wallets, and engineering security for the average person in the age of surveillance. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. We have got an awesome chat today. Told you a little bit about it in yesterday's episode, but we have got Douglas Backham, the CEO of Shift Crypto, on the show today to talk about hardware wallets and securing Bitcoin in the crazy times that we live in. Now, Shift Crypto is actually has been around for a number of years now, and it's Douglas Backham and Jonas Schnelli are the co-founders of this. So they're both really great engineers. You might know Jonas. He's a core developer and maintainer of Bitcoin Core. And we were lucky enough to get Backham on the show and really dig into both what they're building over in Shift Crypto and also just kind of the general challenges of Bitcoin security and how to think about it. So let's go ahead and get into our chat today. But before we do, really quick, shout out to Hexa Wallet for supporting Bitcoin Audible. They are a great mobile wallet. I know a lot of you guys still haven't gotten into actually holding your own keys. And a hardware wallet is the key for your actual savings, like your hardcore large savings. And a good mobile wallet is great for your spending balance or anything that you want to be able to move on a short notice. And that is a Hexa Wallet. Hexa Wallet is a great mobile wallet with lots of features. And we're going to be talking to Douglas Backham all about hardware wallets, so you'll hear about that in just a minute too. But thanks to Hexa for supporting Bitcoin Audible. And now let's get into our chat with Douglas Backham all about Bitcoin security in the digital age.
I just got to say thanks. I've been kind of excited about this conversation here last week or so since we scheduled this, because I really want to dig into hardware wallets and stuff. And you're basically the guy to talk to. So welcome to the show, man. It's good to have you on.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
So I want to start out, like, why don't you give us an introduction as to who you are, the company that you have built, and what were you doing before you got into Bitcoin? Like, kind of give us the nutshell version of before and where you are now, because you're doing some pretty awesome stuff in Bitcoin at the moment.
Yeah, thanks. So nutshell is always a little bit hard for me. Let's see, where do I start? I guess originally I came from Wisconsin, grew up there, was raised there, went to school in Madison for university. There, and then also moved to Atlanta.
What did you go to school for? Was it tech related? Were you always kind of in this stuff?
That was a long time ago, time before Bitcoin existed. So I actually entered and got a degree in mechanical engineering.
Okay.
And then later on, I also got a master's in Georgia Tech in mechanical engineering. I was focused, I guess, on robotics. So like autonomous robotics, artificial neural networks to control them, stuff like that.
That's cool.
And then, interestingly enough, I kind of like to, I guess, go where my spirit leads me. And I ended up switching majors and got a PhD in neuroscience, also at Georgia Tech. And I guess the short story there is I was studying artificial neural networks, but I felt they're a bit primitive. I think they still are. And I thought a lot could be learned from just studying real intelligence. And so I thought maybe I can do that and eventually come back into AI with some things I pick up. That didn't happen. I ended up going into Bitcoin instead. But I'd say, I guess, going where my spirit leads me is kind of like trying to work on things I admire, trying to work on things I think, you know, can change the world. And so studying the brain is for sure one. I think AI eventually will be one. And I think Bitcoin for sure is another.
Yeah. Bitcoin can easily be all consuming when
yes.
once you realize that's a really fascinating background though. I bet that's been pretty handy designing security and hardware wallets.
Yeah, neuroscience, it's a bit distance from hardware wallets, but I guess my actual major was in bioengineering, so neuroengineering specifically. I did pure neuroscience, basic neuroscience, but the labs I was in built technology to better study neurons, and I used that. And so I also picked up, you know, PCB design, you know, embedded microcontrollers, embedded programming, things like that. I had some coding experience from before with robotics. And yeah, interestingly enough, the company I started, originally it was called Shift Devices, was a spinoff of the neuroscience lab here in Switzerland.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So I think yeah, for the university, I guess they were more interested in just having numbers.
Yeah.
Saying they have X and X, so many startups coming out of the university, things like that. But I did have to show, you know, some data transfer, and that was through the like PCB design and embedded microcontrollers and things like that.
So did you basically go from from that to Shift Crypto? So was that actually technically the same company? Like just a evolution of it, I guess you could say?
Yeah, so it was originally Shift Devices. We changed our name to Shift Crypto Security for a while, and now we're a Shift Crypto, just to make it a little bit simpler.
Yeah.
So that was the evolution of the company. And we founded the company back 5 years ago already, in October 2015. And so we've been around for a while, but it's been mainly engineers working on it. Development takes you know, technical background, takes them a little while to figure out what business is all about, actually get some respect for marketing and things like that, how, you know, marketing might be even maybe a bit more important than engineering in some senses if you want to have a successful company. Because if you can have a great product, but if you'd have no marketing, you're not going to sell it.
Yeah, you got to have people to know. Yeah.
Yeah.
People simply have to know. When did you meet, or did you know him beforehand by chance? Jonas Schnelli, he's the co-founder. Is that right? Y'all started the company together?
We did.
Yeah.
And so I guess, you know, while I was still doing neuroscience, I learned about Bitcoin and started, that was around 2013. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the concept of hardware wallets existed. So our company makes hardware wallets, but none were on the market. And it took me a long time after I bought my first Bitcoin to actually feel comfortable holding it. Mm-hmm. Probably like 2 weeks setting up, offline computers with Electrum running it and transferring data and all that.
Oh, I know those days.
It's like, okay, there's a business opportunity there. Mm-hmm. And at the time, there was a lot of, in the hardware space itself, especially with mining equipment, there's a lot of scams going on. Mining equipment that people would buy and it never get delivered, and so on and so on. And so it was an open question, you know, if the hardware wallets would actually get delivered. And so I just started working on my own. Mm-hmm. And showed it to some people at some Bitcoin meetups in Zurich. And Jonas happens to live in Switzerland also. We happen to live in the same city. And that's where we met. He saw me give a presentation and we're like, okay, let's figure out how to make that work.
Well, crap, I need to go back to Switzerland and we need to have like a meetup or something.
actually hang out. Actually got to me and the family went out there. We were kind of it was part vacation, but it was also part scouting alternatives for getting out of Dodge if the end of the world comes. if everything collapses and we have a huge global financial meltdown, is what's the best place to set up shop? And God,
what was your conclusion?
I am a huge fan of Lucerne, and Switzerland was definitely on the towards the top of the list. There are some other countries too, but mostly because Switzerland, I feel like, is in a pretty good financial situation in comparison to most of the modern world. And then at the same time, they actually have cities. The other places that like would be half decent are so sparsely populated, it would feel like, you know, moving into a field.
Yeah.
So like Switzerland is still high on that list. And the fact that there's a bunch of you Bitcoiners over there is definitely a plus.
Yeah, you should try it out for sure.
Curious, before we really kind of dig into the Bitcoin stuff, what's your most, like the most the most important non-Bitcoin thing in your life? Like both just like the thing that you focus on, and then also a philosophy that maybe even has led you to Bitcoin.
Yeah. I guess as you mentioned, Bitcoin can be all consuming, especially when it hits an all-time high, which I think it did just before our talk.
yeah, actually, I don't think we haven't mentioned that yet. Cheers to that.
Oh, we didn't.
Cheers to the all-time high. Super excited.
But let's see. Yeah, hard question. So I'd say, I guess, especially when you're running a startup company, probably a couple things. One is maybe personal sustainability. So, you know, not wasting things in life, taking care of the world.
Oh, yeah.
Staying mentally, physically healthy, keeping your society healthy around you. Yeah, Switzerland's a good place to do that. Lucky it's kind of easy to do that here. And I guess also, I think empowering people has always been something that's been attracted to me. I think it also comes from growing up in America. So like the stereotypical American ideal, where you think if you can, if you believe in something, you try hard, you really try hard and you have dedication, you can do it. And I think, you know, this idea of empowerment that people have, I think Bitcoin can bring that for sure. So with personal, you know, financial sovereignty and all that comes along with it, I found that really attractive. And again, when I first started with the company, you know, making hardware wallets and things like that, I thought, okay, you know, if it's really this difficult to hold Bitcoin, there's a problem. And so part of the reason I started the company, actually not just, you know, make it a hobby for myself, for my friends, is trying to let other people participate in an easier way. So try to empower them, equip them to be able to participate also.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy how much, like you mentioned those kind of those base philosophies of like sustainability and like kind of the idea of being efficient, really, of like being frugal, of being aware of what your cost is in the world. And then at the same time, the self-empowerment, the like the sovereignty and like independence. It's crazy how much a sound money is tied to those ideas. You know, they don't seem like they would have anything to do with money. Money seems like this one thing, and then you would have your personal sovereignty, and then you would have your life together, like, you know, all of these things. But the incentives and the kind of that feedback loop of how you think about value in your life is so deeply connected to those things. It's one of the most fascinating things to me to talk about and like dig into. My episode on a Walking Tall, a guy's take, one of the guys' take episodes. It's just such a fascinating idea about how, and holding your own keys, like having like a hardware wallet, is such a great example of like feeling that personal power of like, this is mine, you know, like this is absolutely 100% mine right now. Like I am holding it. The first time I held my own keys, just like you're talking about, like trying to get a computer that was offline and spin up Electrum and, you know, all of this stuff. But the first time, like I was actually holding Bitcoin, it was kind of exhilarating. Like I was a little bit nervous and panicked because, you know, the transaction didn't show up immediately and I didn't know how, you know, like I was freaking out. It was gone from one wallet and it wasn't in the next one. I was still wrapping my head around all this stuff. But as soon as it showed up, I was just kind of like, I moved this and there was nobody, didn't have to ask anybody's permission. This is mine. Nobody can take it from me. It was just that feeling of self-empowerment was pretty, it was pretty awesome. And that's definitely, definitely core to like the ethos in Bitcoin. And I love it.
That's cool. Gives me flashbacks. I think hardware wallets, as you mentioned, are especially cool in that sense. Cause you know, for a lot of people, Bitcoin is just, it's still this abstract, vague concept.
Yeah.
But then when you actually give them something to physically hold and say, you know, you're controlling your Bitcoin with this, you know, it starts to change their mind a little bit about the possibilities.
Yeah.
Now I think another thing, just a little tangent, like with the sustained sustainability and stuff like that. Yeah, it is interesting how, you know, Bitcoin, I guess, counterintuitively plays a role there. And another thing, maybe you thought about it a lot, talked about it, you know, the cap supply of Bitcoin, I think, is quite special and leads to the sustained sustainability. Like one thing that's always kind of surprised me or seems strange to me about, you know, just the general economic world, and I'm not an economist at all, but just this idea of always wanting to have sustained economic growth is just kind of strange to me. Whereas now you get countries like in Japan or America or some places in Europe, I guess, Japan especially, they're really worried about decreasing population because it has a side effect on the economic growth. But then if you look at the planet, you know, the planet, it's a finite planet. You know, having more and more and more people is just not sustainable. It's not a good thing eventually. And so I think, you know, economic-wise, societal-wise, this idea of cap supply, you know, it'd be interesting how that plays a role.
Yeah, it's that cap supply like really makes you like kind of the most amazing thing about it or the most profound thing about it is it makes you deeply consider the value of the thing you're exchanging it for because you know you have something that is so strictly defined in what it is and that you know it can't be diluted. So whenever you're making that trade-off, you now reconsider the value of everything you're buying. And you talk about countries like just wanting growth for the sake of growth. Like the idea is why, like what growth for what, you know, like we want it to actually achieve something. And it's kind of that debt cycle of, oh, we're just chasing, you know, when we're in debt, when we get our growth for no particular reason, because we're just buying stuff we don't need. But you know, number go up, so yay, everything's great. You get in this cycle that you have to have more people or the economy collapses, you know, that you have to more people to pay off the debts that, the frivolous debts that the current generation went into, or you can't sustain it, but you don't have that problem. The whole thing is flipped with sound money, with just the fact of 21 million changes that entire dynamic, which is just, it's fascinating. It's something that you could do 560 episodes of a podcast and not run out of things to talk about. So I wanted to ask, was there something in particular about Bitcoin? You know, like with the cypherpunks, I would say probably the promise of privacy and censorship resistance. You know, there's a lot of things that you can go at Bitcoin with about, like, was it the cryptography that had you interested? Was it the economics? Like, have you kind of gone down the Austrian economics rabbit hole? Was it smart contracts? Like, what was it? Was there one thing in particular about Bitcoin that just hooked you?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, it's interesting. I guess they always talk about the Bitcoin rabbit hole, but I guess the rabbit hole has many openings, huh?
Yeah.
And eventually you get to a lot of them. But for me, I guess I didn't finish my own self story, but basically before the company, I've been in academia my whole life. So after Georgia Tech, I went to the University of Tokyo for a couple of years. So I know a little bit about Japan. And then my research brought me to Switzerland. And so I've been here for a long time and started the company here. Yeah, just being in academia, so I was always attracted, I guess, to scientific questions. And so Bitcoin solving the Byzantine generals problem, that was really the thing for me. Yeah. And so, of course, the Byzantine generals problem, it's about removing the need to trust. So you don't need to trust people to do financial transactions on the internet. You don't have to trust, like for the Byzantine generals, you don't have to trust the other generals when you're coordinating an attack on a castle. You can plan your attack appropriately. And for Bitcoin, it's, you know, you don't have to trust a random person on the internet if they actually sent you money or if they decided to spend it in a different place, the double spend problem. And so I thought that was extremely, extremely powerful. And to me, so for me, it was quite quick. I was like, okay, this is an extremely powerful concept.
Yeah.
And then it's not a question of if this is going to change the world. It's just a question of the implementation.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Bitcoin was the first one. It seems like it's going to be the dominant one. And then, yeah, that hooked me. And so I wanted to learn more and more and fell down the rabbit hole.
So you had actually known of... you were kind of versed in the Byzantine generals problem prior to finding Bitcoin, because I learned about it when I, like, Bitcoin taught me about the Byzantine generals problem, but you knew beforehand?
No, it taught me also.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So, but just, yeah, I guess, so I was in Japan at the time when I heard about it, and Bitcoin was on the front page of a Japanese newspaper in mid 2013. I thought that was really, really strange. Why is this monopoly money on the front page of a Japanese newspaper? And so I started researching it, and then quickly ran into the Byzantine generals problem, and I could gotcha. Grasp that from a computational perspective.
Yeah, no, that was one of the first ideas that I that was one of those things that, like, when I started going, because I was big into Austrian economics, and that was really kind of Austrian economics and libertarianism is kind of what. Kind of landed me in the lap of Bitcoin, but like straight down like the rabbit hole, like when I was digging into it, the Byzantine generals problem was one of the most fascinating concepts that Bitcoin taught me, that I was just like, I was so immediately hooked, going like, what else is down here? You know, like what other fascinating things have I just completely missed? And that's when I just, the whole cypherpunk thing just, that was my rabbit hole. So yeah, that really was a fascinating one to get stuck on.
Yep.
With your company, like, now that you, like, kind of got into, you saw, like, one of the major problems, which I still think is for like normies, at least for techie people, we've kind of bridged the gap. I love my hardware wallets. I have so many of them now. I think it's still a little bit foreign to most people. But the world is getting even crazier for trying to figure out security. Like, we are really going towards like total surveillance and just hardware and computers integrated into every single thing we touch and everything we do. How do you navigate security? How do you navigate Bitcoin security in that environment exactly?
Well, it's a good thing Bitcoin was, I guess, created to be all about self-sovereignty and privacy and things like that.
Right.
For sure. It's scary. I guess you're also referring to some of these legal or these laws that law agencies want to implement, putting backdoors into encrypted communication.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's scary. Act and all that crap.
Yep. It's difficult. So it's a hard question, because sacrificing personal rights of everyone basically, to make their job easier to protect, a few, but it's hard to counter argue against the stop terrorism angle, but it's really a slippery slope once you get onto it. Yeah. Slippery slope into an authoritarian, can see what's going on in China with like their social credit system and Skynet and things like that. It'll be interesting how that plays out. I think though, I do see some promising things, some societal pushback on this in the recent years. For example, the GDPR rules and European Union, now California, for data protection. Trying to take the ownership of data out of big companies' hands, and you can delete your data and things like that. Really make sure that these companies are respecting your data. I think that's great. Also, I'm quite encouraged by Apple of all companies, and Firefox also, where one of their core selling points in the marketing now is privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Apple, this famous case a year or two ago, I guess, where I think in California also, where some law agency wanted Apple to make a backdoor into an iPhone for a law case, and Apple refused. I think in general, there is some pushback. It reminds me a little bit of when I first created the company. So we're Shift Crypto right now, but Shift Devices. At the time, Edward Snowden was in the news a lot. And of course, he also brings to light a lot of these scary things. My feeling was, people's perspectives were changed by that, but you didn't really see anybody doing anything different. Yeah. And to me, it was more so about not so much that people didn't want to do it, just that they didn't really have the tools to do it. Part of this, empowering people is also thinking about privacy and things like that. I also wanted to, just thinking broader beyond just hardware wallets, I was thinking, maybe I can make devices that not only help people shift their perspective, but can shift their behavior to have a bit more control over their online lives. And so that was why we came up with Shift Devices for the company name. And I think, this whole issue of privacy, when I talk about this story, especially in the beginning, a lot of pushback was like, well, everything's on Facebook anyways. Google knows everything about you. They check your emails and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately is true to a large degree, but not to the whole degree. Because I think there's certain types of data that, anyone's not going to want to share. An example I often use is how many people on Facebook do you see, posting their monthly bank statements, for example?
All my friends do. I don't.
Yeah, or health records, or your government IDs, although
selfies IDs, while they're on the toilet.
Everyone's asking for it. Yeah. I think there is, a class of data that people, there's a line that people are going to draw in the sand. And I think once they draw that line, once they have the tools to actually do something about it, both, hardware in your hand, but also with regulations and things like that, You know, you can start pushing the line back and try to gain a bit more freedom over privacy and respect for people's personal rights.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Snowden, and like I really think, and what's funny is this is kind of the birth of the internet and cryptography. I think it's the book. The story was either in Steal This Book or in, the one about cypherpunks. Oh, I'm going to lose it. It's in my Bitcoin Survivors book list on thecryptoeconomy.com. I'll try to remember to put this in the show notes for anybody who's interested. But it was a story about how, it was talking about how cryptography has actually changed the world, and we haven't really considered how much it has. Just for the fact that we have the ability to release information privately and communicate with journalists and stuff. Basically, like, we live in the age of leaks. You know, for 30 years, people were conspiracy theorists and crazy and idiots for talking about like the government surveillance programs, because there was no like clear example of it happening. It was just a lot of conjecture and circumstantial evidence, I guess you could say. And so they'd taken this crazy conspiracy theory, and then you were just nuts. And then literally the vast majority of them were completely vindicated by the Snowden leaks, Bradley Manning, and WikiLeaks in combination. Through a whole period of like 8 or 9 years, all this stuff just dropped. And that was literally because they were able to release this information, because WikiLeaks is able to talk to people privately on the internet and basically challenge, like, somebody who just literally a handful of people have created a globally powerful information, like I guess it's a journalistic institution, really. But just a way to communicate with people and leak information and crimes about the most powerful people in the world. And that's really crazy. Like, that's super powerful.
Yeah.
But the point that you brought up, though, that I was actually trying to get at, it shifted people's thinking. Like, slowly the culture changed, and bringing up Apple is that they sell themselves, like, whether or not they're even a good they actually are making good on their promise of privacy. They're having to market themselves as privacy preserving in order to get that market. They know that that's something that they should be telling people. But I think you're absolutely right. Yep. Is the main hurdle has been the user experience, that the hardware isn't there. Like, we just hadn't planned for privacy through all of our infrastructure buildup, and slowly but surely, like, guys like you, like the whole Bitcoin space is trying to fix that. Privacy and security has always been a nightmare. It's always been 10 extra steps and 3 inconveniences for me. And it's really getting a lot easier. In the last 10 years, it's shifted dramatically. Which is a really optimistic view, considering all the Earnit and stuff that's landing at the same time. It's just kind of crazy that I agree. I think that we did have a really big shift with Snowden, and it's good to see people actually focused and building in this way, like, seriously, for kind of the normie, I guess you could say. Do you see this? I'm curious about this trend, because one of the major problems, I think, is kind of proprietary, closed source software, hardware, platforms, you know? And there's always been that kind of barrier to decentralization, peer-to-peer. Like it always came with an extra inconvenience, or you had to be a super techie literate person to have your own personal hardware, sort of thing. Do you see this actually crossing the gap? Like, do you actually see personal hardware and open source becoming user-friendly enough to become the norm, I guess you could say?
Yeah. Just a side note. So I dropped out for a while. It actually restarted, but I think I got your whole last question.
Okay.
So if you're asking me questions, I wasn't saying anything. That's why. So the personal and open source hardware. I guess by is that going to stay a niche market or not? I guess you're not meaning niche in the terms of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I personally think that there's going to be a role for it to play.
Okay.
Again, it stems back to some of the thoughts I was thinking when I founded the company, and one of them is this concept of everyone having a physical key in their pockets, a physical key for their digital world, their digital life. And I think as more and more valuable data gets put online, and that's happening every day, every year,
mm-hmm.
There's going to be more and more incentive for bad actors to try to do something with it. And there's going to be more and more incentive for everyday person to try to protect it. And an analogy I like to use is, I think most people still have a key in their pocket for, opening their house, their apartment, starting their car, things like that. And why do you lock your apartment? Probably because you don't want someone to walk in and do something inside your apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as, important aspects of our life get put online, to me, it just seems like a natural evolution. That people are also going to want a key in their pocket for that. And so there's pushback, like, why not put everything on a mobile phone so you don't have, get things out of your pocket? But people still do have keys in their pocket or in their purse. And I think, mobile phones and things like that, they can be hacked in multiple ways. And I think if you want to have actual security, then you need to keep these physical keys offline.
Mm-hmm.
And so hardware wallets do that. That's the exact point of hardware wallets. And I think, this concept, when it comes to security, I think in some ways, Bitcoin and the ecosystem around it can be a leader. And I think that can spread to other industries.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with the idea of, it's a different security concept. For example, if you want to keep your private keys private versus your bank account. So a traditional financial system, if a mistake happens, oftentimes you can just reverse it.
Yeah.
Or if you lose your password to some service online, someone can bail you out and reset your password. But when it comes to cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, gone is gone. If you lose it, you lose your key, there's no more access. No one's gonna bail you out. And I think, that's scary in some ways, but I think, the whole point of hardware wallets is to make it not scary, to make it easy, to make it really, really safe. And I think that for sure they do a great job with that. But I think with this other data that you also need to protect, I think the only safe way to do that will be some kind of way similar to hardware wallets in the future. And so in my mind, there's going to be, people are going to have a key for their apartment. People are going to have a key for their digital world in their pocket.
That's, there's something, in fact, I'm not sure if, maybe this is even in like y'all's plans or something, I've been thinking about that a lot, actually, about trying to figure out, I guess maybe the YubiKey is probably the closest thing to this, is literally having a sort of a two-factor for everything that's just like you said, you know, you have a key. I really like that analogy, by the way, is everybody's got a key to their car and a key to their house and everything on their, you know, in their pocket. Is actually having a little physical device, like the BitBox or something even smaller, like one of those little Wi-Fi receivers you can get now that basically is just a USB plug with like a piece of plastic on the end of it. I have it to plug into my devices that literally activates the devices. Like, that's a slight inconvenience, but it would be one that I would love to have. Like, I'd totally be willing to have or deal with if I knew the device was totally inaccessible without it. And like, I kept it up like a Bitcoin key, you know, like I had it backed up on, like I had my seed phrase, you know, written down somewhere so I could restore it on the new one if anything ever happened or something like that. And maybe I could log into like a super minimal version of my phone without it. You know, all I could do is make phone calls and texts or something like that. But that's something that I really think kind of in this day and age could become more and more important. Maybe nobody else is willing to make that trade-off, but that's something that I've been thinking about more and more of how could I actually do that on like my MacBook and my main computer and stuff. Is that do you know of a product like specifically like that, or does the YubiKey do that actually?
I'm not sure. I think if whatever hardware thing that you want to plug the YubiKey into, if they just adapted their software, then they could use a YubiKey to do that.
Yeah, I guess it's mostly a software problem.
I think more than anything. Yeah. And to me, yeah, that was, I had similar thoughts back when I started the company. You know, but when another lesson besides pay attention to marketing is pay attention to focus. If you want to run a company, so we're very, very focused on hardware wallets. But I think that's something that I find fascinating. You know, if I ever have spare time again, it'd probably be something I'd like to hack together. And I think, yeah, you know, it's hard to say where the market will go, but I think, you know, as Bitcoin becomes more adopted, you know, there's certain mental concepts you kind of have to switch in your mind when you start using Bitcoin. One is this gone is gone idea that we talked about. But then as you kind of fall down the rabbit hole, I mean, not even very far, but you start to realize like these overarching issues in society about, you know, privacy and sovereignty and things like this. And also security. And I think, you know, as more and more people's eyes get open to that, maybe it comes through, you know, Bitcoin, where, you know, your personal financial wealth is at stake. I think that can spread to other non-financial aspects of your life.
Yeah, that's kind of, I definitely think that trend kind of makes sense. You know, you talk about, one of the reasons that I think you're right about, like, kind of the how security has been completely missing, I guess you could say, for the most part up until Bitcoin, is that you always had a way out, right? You always had an exit. You could always call up a 1-800 number and undo the banking transaction, et cetera, et cetera. Everything was so centralized that you didn't have independence or sovereignty, and therefore you never really had to worry about the consequences of not having control, because somebody else always had control. Bitcoin does totally change that. But the really cool thing is that it puts these devices in people's hands. It starts giving an alternative. Like a Sphinx chat is a great example of just like, they took something that was built for payments, and it's like, after payments were already dealt with, after everybody's already got a public key on Lightning, suddenly, why don't we just put an encrypted chat on top of it? A decentralized encrypted chat on top of this infrastructure, and there's no center to it. It's like after you solve the problem of, it's kind of like one of those base foundational issues. Once you solve that, once you change the mindset there and you get people start thinking about security, then you can extend it. Then you can add a new piece of software on top and actually start applying it to all of these other areas that have been missing it for so long, because there was never the incentive there to actually redo the foundation. And Bitcoin is kind of that incentive to do so. Like, what other market has hardware wallets like Bitcoin? And at a retail level, you know, like, that's crazy to think about. That level of security is something that you sell to the average person in Bitcoin.
Yeah. Reminds me of, I've met a few people who used to work for, well, I probably shouldn't say their name, but one of the world leading HSM companies, hardware secure modules. They make private key storage for big banks and so on and so on. Yeah, their opinion was the hardware wallets in the Bitcoin space were quite superior.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's awesome. Yeah, oh, that makes, so, I bet that makes you feel good.
Yeah. Makes you think, oh, am I in the right field from a financial perspective? But yeah, I think we are from, I think there's bigger promise, and you can grow from that.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's pretty funny. Somebody, the whole industry for, you know, building HSM is like, I think Bitcoin has us beat. Cypherpunks come in for 5 years and they take the standard like that. That's pretty awesome. Gotta ask, with, and maybe this is why you're working on the company, what do you think the biggest hurdle for Bitcoin is in the coming years? Is it something like the user-friendly or the security problem, or do you think it's something else?
I think security is always an ongoing thing. I think when you compare it to other industries, there's a good progress here. Maybe in some ways it's not as mature in certain, technical ways or supply chain or whatever ways as some of the other industries. But I think, there's a strong foundation there to really make that advanced. Mm-hmm. But that's always an ongoing kind of cat and mouse issue, where you find problems and you fix it and so on. The UX, of course, is an issue, but to me, I think UX is more of it's a problem, but there's a solution. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I guess the biggest challenge for Bitcoin is probably more so fungibility. Okay. So from a technical, like a core aspect, and of course, fungibility, by that I mean, I guess the definition of fungibility is each coin is equal, or each Satoshi is equal. Mm-hmm. But if you look out there, it's not true, because there's chain analysis that can identify history of coins, and then they can blacklist and whitelist specific coins. Mm-hmm. And then the specific people who happen to have them. And I think, when it comes to decentralization, that's a crucial aspect. And so I think there's solutions here too, but given they're technical, and would require, maybe some changes in the algorithms used by Bitcoin, it's a bit of a bigger challenge to get there.
Gotcha. In that way, what do you think, what's your most optimistic thing with Bitcoin right now in regards to fungibility, something that you think is helping a lot or has the most promise in the next couple of years?
Yeah, well, I think there's solutions there. I think one is if there can be more decentralized exchanges, because decentralization is a solution to centralized problems. And so if, right now, where a lot of the blacklisting happens is in exchanges themselves, which are regulated, they're centralized, and all that good stuff. But if you have a decentralized exchange, then of course there's no central entity to break into that. But I think more so try and figure out, some ways to break the chain analytics algorithms. So trying to break these historical links. So I think PayJoin, for example, is quite promising. Basically designed to break the most common chain analysis algorithms. You know, Taproot is coming to Bitcoin. That looks promising in the sense of, you know, making transactions look a lot similar, having complex payout options, but in a consistent way that you can't read it. And with Schnorr, there's some interesting things that can be done too.
Yeah.
So I think there'll be solutions to that. If there's no, if in some ways it's like, you know, maybe it's good that it doesn't exist right now, because if Bitcoin was truly fungible, truly private, you know, maybe it doesn't quite get the adoption that governments are letting it get right now, have gotten to date.
That's
and
interesting.
As it builds, you know, there's a huge momentum being built behind it, and eventually it's going to be too big to stop. And maybe it already is right now with the, the legal agencies, of course, the law enforcement agencies worry about privacy and things like that, but that's only one aspect of the government. You know, the government's also interested in economic growth. And if you have a huge economy built around Bitcoin, you know, a lot of jobs created, a lot of potential for future growth, that's also something that you don't want to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it'll be interesting how that plays out in the future.
That's an interesting point. The fact that it isn't so like perfectly private right now could be a lot of the reason why governments are hands off or are taking a different approach to it. Whereas we have a permissionless platform where we still can get it to be essentially private down the road and kind of Trojan horse in going, there's no like serious amount of privacy here. You can still do chain analysis and all this stuff. But maybe we'll be using a Tor network, onion routed payment network on top of it, but let's not talk about it yet. So that's an interesting point. But yeah, I'm totally jacked about Schnorr and Taproot in particular for that. And I activated PayJoin on my BTC Pay server, but I'm not sure if maybe nobody's spent with another PayJoin activated wallet or something like that, because I check my transactions just browsing them, you know, whenever invoices come in. I don't know, I guess I'm just a nerd. I just go look at the blockchain and poke around at them. But I don't think any of them have been PayJoin. So I'm not sure if I've not done something right, or if maybe it's just, you know, people are just using wallets in which it's not activated. I'm still waiting for that. Still waiting to see if I'm doing PayJoin.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how adopted it's been to date, besides BTC Pay server. But I think, you know, the fact that it's there, you know, as issues. And also, I think these issues are at a certain level now. Maybe they're not at the level where it's inspiring or like really pushing companies and people to actually, you know, go for it now, but I think that'll come in time. I think also, our company included, but companies in general, it would be good if take some responsibility to try to make these technologies more accessible.
Yeah.
Again, this original idea of empowering people.
Speaking of empowering people, what do you think is, you know, there's a lot of reasons to hold your own keys. Come from context of personal empowerment, but there's also something, and I can't remember who specifically brought it up recently, that just had a really good point, is that it's also kind of from a top-down perspective, critical to the decentralization of Bitcoin, that the keys are also distributed. So what do you think is most important there about holding your own keys? Is there some specific element of it that you think is kind of prime?
Lots of elements. So, I mean, you know, what makes Bitcoin special? It's these ideas of decentralized. You know, no one can control it or manipulate it. This borderless, this neutral, it's open to everyone. Censorship resistance, immutability, you can't change it. And so on and so on. I think this, you know, open to anyone, this decentralized, that's only possible in reality. I mean, and by that, I mean, someone else isn't giving you permission to do it. It's only possible permissionless if you hold your own keys.
Yeah.
And if you have your keys on an exchange is holding it for you, you know, not your keys, not your coins, that's the common saying. And so it's you know, of course, exchanges are needed right now for fiat on-ramps, fiat off-ramps, and things like that. Kind of a necessary evil in some ways, but I think, you know, if we've talked to a lot of exchanges, the people working there aren't evil people. They also want the adoption of Bitcoin, and they also believe in, you know, what makes Bitcoin special. But it's, I guess, baby steps for the public to get actually into it.
Mm-hmm.
But then the thing is, it's, you know, as this goes on and on, as, you know, companies become bigger and bigger, and, you know, money becomes more of a driving factor rather than ideals. You know, it can be a slippery slope where, you know, what makes Bitcoin special can start to fade away. And then, you know, if everyone has their money on an exchange, you know, what's the point of having Bitcoin then? Why not just have a database that's a lot faster?
Why not just, you know, why not just update Swift and put it on Google Drive? Google's everybody can log in. We'll all edit it at the same time. curious, do you think, maybe we should address this first. Maybe I should ask this first, is kind of, what do you think about the major geopolitical trends right now, and kind of the state of the world, the lockdowns, the again, back to the surveillance, all this stuff, the Great Reset, God, I can't, this such a ridiculous thing. And how does Bitcoin fit into that in your mind?
So this year, of course, is a very interesting year. I think I remember reading a quote recently. I think it was Lenin, the Russian Lenin, where he said something like, you know, what did he say? you know, things can take decades and nothing changes, but within weeks, decades can change.
Something like that.
And I think this year is kind of like that. And so, you know, the most obvious answer here, of course, is the money printing, where I think, I have a number written down where, like, in the US dollar, for example, the monetary supplies, like the M1 and M2 monetary supply, has increased by like 25 or 30% this year alone. Yeah. And so, you know, again, Bitcoin with its fixed supply, it was designed to prevent that from happening within itself, to stop this inflation from happening. And, you know, if you're increasing the money supply that much, it's just a matter of time until inflation comes and hits you. I know in Switzerland, especially when we talk about Bitcoin, some of the ideals behind it, people are like, well, the banks work. But the thing is, it's like, you know, we're not Venezuela, we're not Zimbabwe, we're not Argentina. You know, where, you know, a lot of people there, you know, Bitcoin is a good solution for them to avoid the devaluation of their currency. But, you know, if you increase the monetary supply that much, it's inevitable that inflation is going to come. To what degree, we'll see. And I, you know, and you look at, I think this idea is permeating, you know, MicroStrategy, of course, for example, made it quite public that they're putting their reserve assets into Bitcoin, $500 million worth of reserve assets, because they don't believe in the long-term stability of the US dollar. And you know, they're, I guess, the first public company or first company to publicly state that. But for years now, for a few years now, at least, you know, a lot of other companies have been doing this. A lot of endowment funds have been doing this. They just haven't been public about it. They're doing it through a series of hedge funds, basically, to kind of keep it secret. MicroStrategy kind of brings it out in the open. And so it'll be interesting, you know, what we see is there's a lot of, I guess, institutional adoption now of some of the core ideals of Bitcoin. And, you know, that's kind of, yeah, we had the all-time high today. I guess we're going to have a few more all-time highs in the months to come. And so, of course, this money printing to save the economy, you know, there's going to be consequences to that.
Yeah. Do you think that's what's driving this bull market and will continue to? Is it the institutional and hedge funds at corporate treasury kind of thing? Is there something specific that stands out? Is it the Michael Saylor thing? Or do you think there's something else behind this?
I'm just speculating, but we've heard and from what we heard from our connections, it does seem like it's strongly institutional adoption right now. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to say also because, you know, PayPal just allowed people to, purchase and sell Bitcoin, although you're stuck inside their ecosystem. But PayPal, I guess, has, they're regulated by New York State. So they have to have one-to-one reserves by law. And so as more people buy Bitcoin, PayPal has to buy also. And so that could be, a path for more and more retail people coming in. It'll be interesting to see what numbers they actually report in the future. But I guess from what I've seen and heard, it really is institutional adoption right now. So it's still early in this next bull run. One thing I think is really interesting also is when governments will start to play a role also.
Yeah.
Because in October, you may have heard Iran.
Yeah.
Decided to adopt Bitcoin basically as a response to trade sanctions being locked out of the US dollar. So their central bank can accept and use cryptocurrency to pay for imports. Mm-hmm. All the Bitcoin miners in the country have to sell their coins directly to the central bank. And so there's a huge, you talked about geopolitical game. This is going to be interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. How long do you think that's kind of the entrance of it? Because obviously right now, I did an episode specifically on this, on the Iran thing, because that honestly is, it's a whole lot quicker that I think that domino started falling than I had expected it to. Undoubtedly, they're not doing much business, but the fact that they're mining licenses require them to sell to the central bank is just really crazy. What's your in referencing the Lenin quote of 10 years only a couple of weeks can happen, and within a couple of weeks 10 years can happen, what's the time frame? Like how quickly do you think that ball will get rolling? Is that like right around the corner, or is that still something that might take a decade?
I have no idea.
Speculation, obviously, but yeah.
Yeah. I think within 10 years, there will be significant movement there for sure. I think if you look at the other countries, like the superpowers around the world, it seems like what they're trying to do right now is instead of adopting Bitcoin, they're trying to make their own coin. And so China, for example, seems to be quite advanced in making their own stablecoin for their own currency. And again, I think a lot of the motivation there is to not be locked into, US dollar ball and chain, I guess. Be able to bypass that in banking and so on. I can imagine Russia doing the same. But publicly, other central banks have quickly followed. So the euro, the Japanese yen, the US dollar, they're all looking into making their own now. But again, you know, I think that makes sense from their perspective because, you know, they can control it. But the thing is, it's like, you know, what we talked about at the very beginning, what you mentioned a lot, sound money, right? Sound money tends to win in the end, and Bitcoin has a bit more of a solid foundation there.
Yeah. So it'll be really fascinating to see that play out. Probably scary, probably really scary, but popcorn necessary nonetheless. You know, with Iran, like knowing the history of, you know, the CIA and the NSA and how, I guess you could say, sneaky and backdoor they are. They really, Iran Central Bank better get themselves a BitBox or something, because they might lose that Bitcoin really quick. Keeping that on a freaking Windows XP computer they got in their front desk. Are you a big proponent of multisig? Because I noticed the BitBox was actually integrated into Spectre when I finally, like, I'm really jacked about Spectre. I've only recently started playing with it, but I was super stoked to be like when I was looking at the wallets and I noticed right off the bat that BitBox was there, because it was like straight up when I was testing out my BitBox and I hit Spectre like the same day. I just like took a day of just like playing with things. Are you big on multisig?
I would say myself, and I think a lot of people in our company are probably mixed on multisig. Okay. And I think it depends on the use case. So usually simple is safer. Mm-hmm. And right now a single sig is much, much simpler than multisig. And what we see, you know, in our history is the biggest risk is more so user error, like for example, forgetting a password, things like that. And multisig is quite complicated to get right. We have a couple of blog posts about some of the pitfalls of multisig on our blog. You can check it out. Your audience can check it out.
I'll try to remember to add that to the show notes. I might just read one of those on the show. I don't think I've done a specifically dedicated one on like the risks and or the trade-offs of multisig. That's probably a good one to hit into.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, my colleague Marco could probably talk about it a lot better than me. But you know, to make it, you know, to state it simply, there's an issue with some conceptual issues that you have to really verify all of the XPubs of all of the keys. Mm-hmm. That form up the multisig. For example, you need to not only verify them, you also need to record them. So, you know, if you have a 2 of 3 multisig setup, a common belief is, okay, if I lose one of the keys, I'm okay because I can recover with the other two. But that's not true, because you need all 3 pub keys in order to recover your funds to recreate the addresses, basically, and stuff like that. I'm not saying exactly right. I have to check the blog post again, but
I think I know what you're talking about, the fact that generating the addresses, the space of what you like, just the public key that you could be using to generate addresses is basically as large as the private key space, or comparatively so, that if you just even, and this is something that I learned, I think I really hit home Phil, I was talking with Phil at BitBlock Boom, and he was talking about this, is that if you actually lose your wallet data that like just stored on your computer, which is obviously your pub keys, as you're talking about in this example, that when you plug your hardware wallets back in, you might not generate, or you're definitely not going to actually, you're not going to generate the exact same public keys and the exact same derivation path and everything to recreate your addresses, and you could just lose it in never regenerating the same address again and not know where it is.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's yeah. definitely something that I was not fully aware of and kind of surprised me yeah. when I dug into that.
And when you're dealing with hardware wallets, you also have to, you can't store it in your wallet.dat file. You need to store these XPubs on the hardware wallet itself also. And there's an example, like with hardware wallets, the assumption is that the computer is already potentially hacked. So there could be mm-hmm. malware on your computer. And so you need to be able to compensate that with the hardware wallets. But if you're not storing your cosigner XPubs on the hardware wallet, the malware can basically swap them out with ones they own. And so you could be signing a transaction and basically the coins go to, or you can create an address to receive stuff, but it's basically not in your possession. It's in the possession of the thief.
Yeah. Somebody else has generated it ahead yeah, of exactly. Your wallet or whatever. Yeah, yeah. That's a good point.
So and a lot of multisig implementations now and a lot of tutorials you see, they don't consider this. And so if you follow them, you could still be at risk. And so some education is needed there to kind of make that a bit safer. So I'd say it's, for my own personal use case, I probably wouldn't trust it at this moment. Mm-hmm. I think maybe in months or a year time, that'll change. Gotcha. As this becomes more understood. But that said, I said it depends on the use case. So I think there are use cases that do make sense. For example, multi-vendor multi-sig to reduce vendor risk. If one of the hardware wallets has a bug or someone hacks it or there's an exit scam, things like that, you could still be safe mm-hmm. by basically spreading your multi-sig over multiple vendors. I think also when it comes to like the $5 wrench problem, someone can beat secrets out of you.
Keys out of your head.
Yep. I think multi-sig can make sense there also because you can spread, if you don't want to access it all the time, you can keep the keys in different locations where there's some, makes it harder or there's some, real life hurdles you have to get over in order to access all of them. I think it makes sense there. And of course, with companies, when you need to have, multiple people or multiple departments sign off, it makes sense there too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, still have to be aware of these pitfalls though.
Yes. So you're probably right. Or that's a really good point to bring up about that is just that multi-sig might not just be, because there could be a way to kind of overcome those hurdles, maybe even from kind of the hardware generation side of things. And there may be some sort of fun little tweak or trick with Taproot and Schnorr there. You're probably right.
It can definitely be overcome, but then it's just going to be an issue of implementing, testing, getting some security people to hack on it. Mm-hmm. And then UX is probably the biggest issue.
Gotcha. Yeah. Probably a decent analogy is that multi-sig might be where, like me being familiar with it, I still was kind of shocked that I didn't quite know that risk was there until BitBlock Boom. Probably multi-sig is kind of where just normal Bitcoin storage was in 2013. Is that there's an additional risk and it's much more techie and those trade-offs are still there that aren't super user-friendly. I mean, just talking about from the idea of noobs, anybody who's new to this podcast, which is decent group, it seems like for the last couple of weeks, a lot of people might just be searching Bitcoin in podcasting these days. Probably 90% of noobs were totally lost as soon as we started talking about multi-sig. That's probably a good indication that we're not quite there yet. What do you think on that is still the biggest UX hurdle for noobs? Is it a like terminology thing? Is it still somewhere in the software? What do you think the biggest challenge right now still is?
Yeah. I think it's actually coming down to education, in the sense of again shifting your mindset about certain things, about how Bitcoin works. I think a lot of wallets now, a lot of hardware wallets also, and especially hardware wallets, do make it a lot simpler than it was just a few years ago. So I think it's not so complicated anymore. And so I think, speaking mentally, one of the biggest is just a mental block. So a lot of people we talk to, one of the big reasons they don't want to hold their own keys is basically they don't know what they're doing. And, you know, even if you give them a tutorial about how to do it, they're like, okay, this is going to be complicated. I need to spend, you know, a Sunday when I have a Sunday free and spend the whole day and just kind of go over this until I understand it and do it and things like that. One thing our company does is try to make it extremely, extremely simple. So you can basically set up your wallet within a couple of minutes. And I think, you know, Bitcoin itself is such a foreign concept to people. Then the next step where you actually store it, you know, is even a deeper unknown concept. And so I think, you know, there needs to be a lot of education about what it is, about how it's, you know, actually not that complicated. I know, like for me personally, even in 2013, I was actually surprised how easy it was to use Bitcoin to buy things online. It's really, really simple. And, you know, even compared, whereas like credit cards is getting harder and harder by the year, where you have to have, you know, your second factor if you have a strange purchase. You know, I recently went across the border into Germany to do some shopping, but I forgot my phone and the credit card would basically block all the transactions. I'm speculating it's because they figured out where the phone was and it wasn't with me. And then online, you have to enter a lot of information. It's just complicated. And I think, you know, Bitcoin is and can be and is simpler in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, with this mental block for people, you know, it's also getting over the fear of, you know, Bitcoin. You know, it's powerful to say you can be your own bank, but then you also have to be your own security team also. And that's scary.
You have to know how a bank works.
So hardware wallets are designed to, hardware wallets are designed to make it so you don't have to know how a bank works. It can be your own little personal bank. And, you know, and just simple things like, you know, you don't have to buy a whole Bitcoin in order to get into Bitcoin. You can buy a part of a Bitcoin. You know, if you make a backup, you don't have to update it all the time because your coins actually aren't on your wallet. The wallet's probably a bad name. Your coins are actually on the public blockchain, and your wallet is just the key that allows you to move it from one place to another. And you know, it'll just take some time for people to grasp these concepts. But I think it reminds me of some early stories where you know, back in 2013, where it was a lot more complicated. I remember hearing some stories from some friends about how, you know, they had like extremely, extremely non-technical people that got into Bitcoin really, really fast. And the reason was because they heard that they could use Bitcoin to buy drugs. And so, you know, if people the have a motivation, but you know, if people have a motivation to learn something, even if they're non-technical, they're going to do it. And so, you know, drugs, you know, you get a lot of, you know, kickback, like, oh, it's used for illicit behavior and bad stuff like that. But
that's nefarious.
But there's another thing. It's like, you know, if a technology is not useful for illicit behavior, it's just not useful for anyone.
Yeah.
And so it's just a question of, you know, what you're going to use it for. And I think, you know, we talked about this funny year that we're having right now. And I think it's becoming a bit more tangible, you know, what about inflation, you know, eating away at your retirement savings. You know, you have your money in a bank or bonds, and you know, you're not getting a return on your interest anymore. The interest rates are near zero. And so some of these concepts of Bitcoin are becoming a bit more tangible for a lot of people. And, you know, if you make, I think the solution to this education is, you know, really making clear the why to people, and then people are going to figure out on their own.
Yeah, the why is becoming more and more obvious. And people who normally would not be asking those questions or even considering it, I feel like are. Like the mental framing has shifted massively in 2020. And kind of, I think the lack of trust has exploded in kind of traditional institutions and infrastructure and banking and finance and all of that stuff, but the political sphere obviously as well. It's funny you talk about like just that Bitcoin is actually pretty simple, but that it's still, I guess, foreign to everybody. I'm still constantly shocked, you know, like the whole credit card and PIN and punch in all your information and put the CVV code and stuff on the back. You think about that, like it seems like, oh, we do it every day. It's like super obvious, but it's crazy complicated in like a bunch of different steps. Whereas Bitcoin is literally just, you know, get the address and then send to it. And it's basically the same thing for any way that you do it. Even on Lightning, like all the different layers of technology, they just kind of have different versions of addresses in a sense. What's funny is I forget that that is still so alien to people. I had people recently, some old friends in particular, asking how to just withdraw Bitcoin. And I'm just like, oh, you send it to your address. And they're like, silent for like an hour, and then I get another text back. It's like okay, what is an address? You know, like literally, like, and I'm like, oh crap, like I really gotta, I've been stuck in it so long, it doesn't even doesn't even cross my mind that somebody's never done that before, you know what I mean? It's kind of funny. Actually, since I brought it up, because I was curious, I know we're kind of getting to the end of our time frame here, but I wanted to get your take on Lightning, and particularly how it, like, Lightning is kind of like the hot wallet version of everything, right? And how can Lightning talk to or make use of hardware wallets, do you think?
Yeah, good questions. So I can't answer too much about Lightning. I haven't dug into it too deeply on a technical layer. But, you know, in general, I guess now that I know you have more and more of a general audience, you know, Lightning is a solution for Bitcoin to basically increase the bandwidth drastically, vastly, immensely. Because the current Bitcoin blockchain, due to security trade-offs, is quite slow, fills up quite fast, and when it fills up, it can be quite expensive. And so, Lightning is a solution to all that. And so, I think, you know, it's called a second layer. So layering makes sense. You know, you look at the internet; it's full of a bunch of layers. Has a base layer and then a bunch of application layers on top of it, communication layers, and so on. It works to make the internet go around the world, and I think, you know, Lightning or something like it makes a lot of sense also. How it works with hardware wallets? Yeah, that's a good question. It's something our team thinks about a lot. But you mentioned Lightning. Maybe that's more of a hot wallet kind of thing. And by hot wallet, that means your private key is a bit hotter. For example, it could be on your mobile phone or your computer. Maybe that could be the solution, where you could think of it like in banking terms as a kind of a split between a savings and a checking account. So maybe you could have a hardware wallet where you have your a bit more security, like with your savings, whereas you send a little bit of funds to your Lightning wallet in order to actually use it for spending and commerce and things like that. And so I think that could be a thing. Lightning, I haven't been keeping up with the latest, but there's always this watchtower issue with Lightning, where basically, it's getting technical, but with Lightning, you need to be able to watch the, I guess counterparties a word, but watch wherever you're sending coins so that they don't try to cash out before before they send you coins, before that gets recorded. Maybe mm-hmm. they can try to cash out and steal your funds. So there's concept of watchtowers that basically need to watch for this happening. And then basically the person who tries to steal gets severely punished, where they basically give up all of their funds. And so the watchtower, then it has to be an online thing. It has to be online all the time. And so I think then, putting it on a mobile phone makes a little bit more sense in that case, because a mobile phone is an always on online device, whereas a hardware wallet, it's nice. Once you unplug it, it's not connected.
Yeah, nothing's at risk anymore. It's separate. Yeah.
And so like the watchtower, if you do detect that, you have to sign something. So you need the private key hot, in a sense, like that. And so I think, it's Lightning is very fascinating, very promising. But how to integrate it exactly with hardware wallets, I think, is still a bit of an open question.
Gotcha. No, I definitely, like, that's the model I feel like makes the most sense, at least right now. I mean, that's exactly what I do. Now I don't keep anything, any amount, not on my hardware wallet. Like, not on my BitBox or my Trezor or whatever, the two that I'm mainly using now. Oh, I do use my Kobo a little bit too. But I don't keep anything. It's on one of those now, or it's in Lightning. Like, I really don't have, I have like a little bit of a bridge basically in two mobile wallets. And that's pretty much it. It's like Hexa and Green, I think, are the only two that I've used. Everything else is now just straight Lightning. So it's kind of cool to like that's kind of the way I use it. I think about it as if I'm not using this in my hot wallet, which is Lightning these days, I put it behind multi-sig or behind a hardware wallet. And I shouldn't have to touch it much, like it needs to be offline. It needs to be kind of away. It needs to have a layer, an extra layer away from my mobile device, I guess you could say. It's kind of cool. I think that's definitely the model that really rings true right now. Very curious to see what happens with something like Taproot and the ability to, I think I read something that somebody was talking about needing, having Lightning done in such a way that certain size transactions required a two-factor, like during like a span of time. And I don't know exactly how it worked, mm-hmm. but it would be something where you'd have to plug in a hardware wallet and confirm that you're sending more than 2 million sats or something like that. Whereas anything below that could actually go through normally on your hot wallet. So I'm really curious about that. That'll be really interesting to kind of see that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
Yeah, yes, that sort of stuff get worked out. Speaking of, I know the BitBox is coming from a noob-friendly sort of perspective. I was really excited when you guys contacted me about it and I started playing with it, is because, honest to God, it's one of the simplest, if not the simplest. Sometimes I'll buy a hardware wallet and I'll be kind of surprised. Like, I love the cold card, but it's pretty complicated. Like, I wouldn't recommend it to a noob, but hardcore Bitcoiners, I'd be like, you got to get your calculator, right? Yeah. the BitBox really is kind of the most user-friendly, no-nonsense thing. Like, I went from start to finish, and the desktop app is about the simplest thing you can get. Like, it's just got a a send and receive. It's super clean. There's nothing in the way. So I'm really excited to see, and I can't believe I didn't know about this thing. You talk about like marketing being important. If y'all have been around for that long, I literally did not know about the big box until you guys contacted me, which I'm a little bit shocked about. I kind of feel like I thought I knew all the hardware wallets and all the gadgets in Bitcoin. I'm kind of embarrassed. But what future plans do you guys have for this thing? What's kind of next in line for either your hardware wallet line or your, I know you got like the steel wallet thing and some other products. Like, what's the future look like for Shift Crypto?
Yeah, thanks for the kind words. That was definitely one of our goals, is to make it as simple as possible. So it's nice to hear that. I guess heading back to marketing is to let the world know about us. So okay. That's a problem. It's a problem when you have engineers founding a company. Mm-hmm. That's the main thing. But as far as the product line itself, we did recently, I guess, narrow our focus more so to the Bitbox and the app itself. We had actually worked a lot on a full node. It's called the Bitbox Base. It's actually a really, really slick product. But we decided, you know, just to make it work, you can't do too many things at once. And so mm-hmm. we decided to really focus on the Bitbox hardware wallet itself. We had a tamper-evident packaging product also, but those are on pause for now while we, I guess, try to build the business around the hardware wallet. And, sweet. You know, that really allows us to, you know, take our products to a higher level. And I think that's showing now. And so I think, you know, people, you know, of course, people aren't going to believe me, but I think speaking about my own hardware wallet, but I think the Bitbox can stand alone on its own quite well. I think it's quite superior in both the UX and the security concept to a lot of the competitors. And so, we're continuing to focus on that, and we want to make it, a lot easier for people still. And so I guess touching back on this why, and, you know, what's the first stage of the journey? You know, it's people don't think of hardware wallet at the first stage, right? Mm-hmm. They think about, how can I buy something? And so we want to add, a bit more of these features to help make it easier for the user from day one. So fiat on-ramps, off-ramps inside of the app, possibly some cryptocurrency exchanges and things like that. If it really is the simplest wallet, you can say, you know, if someone wants to get into Bitcoin, you can just give them a Bitbox and that's all they need. They can buy it and they already got state-of-the-art security on the side. And so we're going in that direction. And I think, you know, longer term, of course, we have our eyes open for, how the space evolves. If it's new hardware itself, making our existing hardware, you know, sleeker or whatever, adding new features. We have a lot of ideas in mind, but just I guess monitoring the space to see what we do next. And if there's any users out there that have a Bitbox, we're happy to hear back from you on what you think we should be moving, which direction you think we should be moving.
Heck yeah. I think focus is such a, one of the things that always stuck with me about that story that had stuck with me about, I think I read it in a Steve Jobs autobiography or something. I heard about it at some point, but how they had like a brainstorming session with like a whole bunch of people, and they like wrote down like 80 things on like a board of like all the plans and dreams and all the things they wanted to do. And he said, all right, pick three, because everything, we're throwing everything else out and we're focusing on three. And that's something that y'all could really have at your advantage, just because so many people in this space, like I get excited about a lot of products and a lot of projects and all the things that are happening in this space, but I do see a lot of the biting off more than they can chew. Is trying to do all of it and then talking about all of it and trying to push for all of it, like the whole package and everything, rather than focusing on one thing and getting it absolutely right, getting it absolutely as user-friendly as possible and as streamlined as possible. And I think there's something to say about being really, really focused, particularly right now on, I guess, really simplification of security and user-friendliness. So I'm really excited, and I legit appreciate what you guys are doing and the hardware wallet that you guys have made. And thank you for contacting me, because I really don't know how long it would have been before I kind of bumped into it again. It's a critical part of my need all of the Bitcoin gadgets arsenal.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's very nice words. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. With that though, I guess we should, let's wrap this up. Do you have anything else you want to add to any final words to the Bitcoiners out there on holding their keys or anything like that?
No, I think we covered a lot, but I'll just say, if anyone's interested in hearing about us more, check out our website, shiftcrypto.ch. And we're really, really appreciate if you have ideas and hearing from you about what you think, like you as in the audience in general, the hardcore Bitcoiners and also the new people to the space. Really interested in hearing from you about what you think about hardware wallets in the future also.
Heck yeah, absolutely. Are you on the Twitters? I know Shelly is, obviously.
So yeah, our company's on Twitter, and I'm on it to a small degree, but that'll be growing in time.
Okay. Let me. What's that handle? So I don't forget it. Is it just Shift Crypto? Shift Crypto HQ. I got it. Okay. Yeah, I'm following.
That's it. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Shift Crypto HQ. And my own is Douglas Bockham.
At Douglas Bockham. All right. I got you written down, so I'll remember to put it in the show notes. Dude, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've been eager to, I realize I have not picked anybody's brain about hardware wallets. First show about hardware wallets and Bitcoin security in that way. It's been
honored.
Yeah, man. I appreciate it, man. And I'll talk to you next time. We'll do it again in maybe a year or so, when we enter the new phase of this thing and we're on the back end of the bull run and we see all the craziness that's happened. And we're talking about all time highs at breaking the 150,000 mark or something.
Sounds like a good plan.
Heck yeah, man. All right. Thanks so much, Douglas. Take it easy, dude.
Thank you. Thank you, guy.
All right. So we actually kept hanging out and chatting for another, 30 or 40 minutes after this, just talking about all sorts of crap. It was really great to get to sit down and pick Douglas's brain for a few hours. And I'm really happy he could come on the show. For anybody who out there who is kind of ready to make the move to a hardware wallet, you know, who's starting to get a significant amount of savings and wants a straightforward, secure, and easy to use hardware wallet, the Bitbox is really hard to beat. They are a sponsor of this show, so I might be a little bit biased, but it's solid AF in my honest opinion. So, on that, actually, I'm probably going to have a video pretty soon. I can't promise anything just because video is much slower for me. It's been a while. I'm a little rusty. But I'm going to have a video on the Bitbox as a walkthrough for those who are interested in getting one. And I also have plans for the other hardware wallets. I've got a bunch of them here now. So don't forget to check out the YouTube channel. That is Guy Swan. Because I'll have tons of different hardware wallets videos up there. I love to geek out on these things. Bitcoin security is just such an interesting topic to me. And so don't forget to check that out. And if you want your Bitbox, go through Guy Swan
swann.com/bitbox if you want the Bitcoin only edition, which I recommend. If it does less, you know, don't bug it with a whole bunch of altcoins. It by its nature, it's got a smaller attack surface, fewer things can go wrong. That's always a good rule to a rule of security. So don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and the YouTube channel. Follow Douglas Backham, Jonas Schnelli, and Shift Crypto on Twitter. Stay up to date on what they are doing and their future plans. And yeah, join us in the Sphinx. For anybody who hasn't done the Lightning thing, check out Sphinx Chat and jump in the Bitcoin Audionauts tribe. The group over there has gotten really big, and it has been really fun to do the whole streaming sats thing. So if you haven't gotten started with Lightning, that is the way to do it. But I will catch you next time on Bitcoin Audible. And until then, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.